We will start the technical part of the course after all this introduction that we did last week. So it will be quite technical now for a couple of days. Not so much physics, although, you know, the technicalities are actually really close to the physics as well. So what we will do basically this week is summarized here. So we will do exact diagonalization, which means that we want to write down the Hamiltonian matrix, and we want to use symmetries of the Hamiltonian, so conservation laws. So what we will use specifically in these spin chains is we will use the fact that the models that we look at typically conserve the magnetization. We will look at translational invariant states, so there we can label the states by momentum. We also will have a parity in some cases and spin inversion symmetry in some cases. Now, all these symmetries one can discuss using the language of group theory, which I will not do here because if you just start out, it can actually just be confusing and it will not help at all. So later, when you know something about how to use these symmetries, maybe it's useful to use group theory or results of group theory when you consider some complicated lattices where you don't necessarily want to work out all the symmetries yourself. But here we are just going to look at spin chains, and these symmetries are really trivial. And you will see that to incorporate the symmetries in your program, you really only need to know basic quantum mechanics combined with some common sense. So we don't need group theory here. All right, so what I will do is first discuss just the mathematical aspects of this, which is in the end quite simple. And then we will look at pseudocodes for how to actually implement these things on the computer. So there will be some things that resemble Fortran in some way, but written in with more mathematical notation, and just the key parts of the program, so not discussing all the surrounding things that are basically trivial, just the key elements that you will need to understand. And then I will make programs available for you which are really written in a way which closely corresponds to these pseudocode segments. So if you have these slides, the PDF files that I post on the web, and you look at these programs, I think you can really understand what's going on, and you will be prepared to write your own codes for some more complicated, well, for some other cases if you need. Okay, so when we have done these technical aspects, discussing all these symmetries, I want to show some examples of how we can use exact diagonalization. So we will look at the ground state properties and also some excitations of the Heisenberg chain. So we already discussed in qualitative terms a little bit what are the properties of the Heisenberg chain. So now we will explicitly check those things. And we will also look at this quantum phase transition into a valence bond solid state in the J1, J2 chain, which we also discussed a little bit before. Okay. So let's look at the model we will work with most of the time. So now when I develop all this formalism, we will just look at the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain. And we have looked at the Hamiltonian before, so you know what it is. And in particular, you know that we can write it in this form, where this is the term which is diagonal, so we choose the z-axis as our quantization axis. So this is the diagonal or Ising term, and we have this off-diagonal spin-flipping operators. So when we do exact diagonalization of this kind of state, it's really convenient to use the bit representation of integers in the computer. So we need some way, when we want to construct our matrix, we of course need to label the states in some way, that this is state 1, this is state 2, and so on. Since we have a spin 1/2 system, the spin, the z is up or down, plus minus 1/2, In the bit representation, what we use is we directly let the bits of an integer correspond to these spins. So in that way, this ordering of the states, the labeling of the state with just an integer as we need to do to make the matrix, basically is given for free to us by the computer. So the state with all spins down, we call zero. So here I label the state starting from zero, not one, and that's just for convenience. Well, we could easily add one, but we can start anywhere we like, right? So all spins down, that's the integer which has all bits zero, and of course that corresponds to zero in the base 10 representation. Now the state where one, the first spin is up, the rest is down, is this state, this bit representation. So now there's a potential little bit source of confusion here. So you see, when we write down these states, we start with the spin which we refer to one, the first spin. So this is SZ1 and going up to SZN. But when we use the bits, normally the rightmost bit is the one which corresponds to 0 or 1, right? So you see that the order of these things is somehow reversed here. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But it's not a big deal. Yep.
What is 0, 1, 2, and 3?
You mean this one?
Yeah.
Okay, so when we construct our matrix, we will need to order the states. Right, so just the labels of the state, right? So when we have a matrix, there will be some states like this. I mean, the matrix elements will correspond to, so for example, the Hamiltonian. There will be some elements in the Hamiltonian taking us from these states to these states. So we need just some way to enumerate the states. And of course that is in principle arbitrary. There is nothing that says that we need to consider this as the first state in our basis, and this as the second state in our basis. But this is just convenient because let's say that we, instead of these bits, we just store these numbers 0 and 1, or we could store plus and minus 1 in some vector. So we could declare some, whenever we need to store a state, we could just make a vector of size n, and we could put those, you know, plus 1, minus 1, whatever, in that vector, or we could put zeros and ones. Well, then we need some way to go from that to this label A, which is, you know, the ordering of the state within our Hilbert space. And of course we could do that exactly in the same way. If we use zeros and ones, we could just manually use treat this as a binary number and create the sum. For example, if we just store, if the bits are 0 and 1, we could just say that, okay, A, which is the label, is sum over I goes from element 1 to n, so let's say this is element 1 and this is element n, and then it would be a spin on site I, which would be the 0 or 1, times 2 to the I minus 1. We could, for example, construct the state label in that way, given those spins. But if we use the bits of the computer, this is given to us for free, right? Because an integer has 32 bits, right? And whatever we put for those bits, you know, the computer gives us that as a base 10 number. So we don't need to compute that summation ourselves. It's really done by the computer. And we will see later on when we start to act. So when we construct the Hamiltonian, we will need to act with the Hamiltonian on states. So then we need to flip, for example, spins. So these terms here, they flip spins. And that we can do just by manipulating bits in these integers. So most, if not all, programming languages have some functionality for manipulating bits. And those are very fast operations as well. So this is really key. Oops, now I get confused because I start to use this clicker here. This is really key to understand this representation of the states. And again, in principle, it's arbitrary. We could label the states anywhere any way we like. So we have 2 to the n states for spin 1/2, and we just need to order them in some way. And it just happens because of the possibility to use the bit representation that this is the most convenient way to do it. So then when we construct the Hamiltonian, among these states, this is what we need to construct, and these I and j, they go from 0 to 2n minus 1. That's how many states we have. So please ask if there's still something unclear about this, because if this is unclear, the rest will be. Yeah?
Are we treating the state with all up and all down as
identical? Yes, I mean, all up and all down, those will be, so you see here, all down, that's the integer 0. And all up would be the integer 2 to the n minus 1. Right, so there's, so we have all the states, which corresponds to all the bits starting from position 1 to n. They will, all those numbers will somehow be represented in this list. Right. Okay, now we are now dealing with a spin half system. What if we have a higher spin system? For example, a spin 1, we need 3 possible states per site. Then obviously we cannot use this in this form. What we could do, for example, for spin 1 is we could use 2 pairs of 2 bits to represent a spin 1, and then we would waste a little bit because 2 bits corresponds to 4 possible states. In a spin 1 system we have 3, so we would waste some space, but that's not such a big deal. We can do that. Well, by the way, of course, here if we use normal integers which have 32 bits, we are limited to a spin chain of length 32, right? So that you have to keep in mind. On the other hand, we can use long integers, which normally are 64-bit integers, and then we can go up to 64. But in practice, we will anyway be limited to something around 30, 32. If we really push it, we could go to 40 or something like that. Because, as we will see, because this size of the Hilbert space grows so fast that we can not deal with it anyway. So, for sure, long integers will be sufficient, and for most of what we are doing, just the normal for 32-bit integers will be fine. Now we could also, when we go to higher spins or do some more complicated kind of system, we could also construct a vector containing the states, site states. There's nothing wrong with that, but it would take a little bit longer to do that, because then we manually need to go from the state given as a set of numbers to whatever labeling we are using. Well, as we will see later, even in the case of the spin 1/2 system, in the end, this is not the labeling we are going to use when we use symmetries. So this is the labeling we use when we don't use any symmetries, but still, later you will see that this bit representation will be useful, even if the ordering of the states will not be exactly like that. All right, let's move on. Hopefully it will be clear when we go on. Okay, let me just say then about actually diagonalizing. So when we have constructed the Hamiltonian, which in this case here, you can imagine that it's not difficult to construct this Hamiltonian. We have all these states, and the Hamiltonian on a state is very easy to compute what you get when you act on a state. So we can easily construct that matrix, and then we need to diagonalize it. So, of course, we use that, do that on the computer because we cannot do it by hand. So we give we want the eigenvalues and possibly the eigenvectors as well. So when we do it, we are not going to discuss actually how diagonalization works. So that's an applied mathematics task that you can read about in numerical recipes or somewhere if you really want to know how it works. Yeah.
Since we're dealing with an exceptionally large matrix, but which is almost entirely made of zero entries, are you using sparse matrices to?
Okay, good point. So we will, yeah, so later we will talk about the Lanczos method, which is a sparse matrix method. But, you could. So it really depends. I mean, normally, actually, I would not use a sparse matrix routine for these things, but it may actually help. But for sure, when we go to really big systems, when we talk about the Lanczos method, that is a sparse matrix method. But it's right. I mean, there will be mainly zeros in this matrix. Anyway, so what these routines give us, whether it's a sparse matrix routine or some other routine, it will give us the eigenvalues in a vector, and it will also normally give us a matrix, which I call U here, which is the diagonalizing matrix. So this U written in this way, after you have diagonalized the Hamiltonian, if you put the Hamiltonian here, that gives you a diagonal matrix. So if you want to compute some matrix elements of some other operator, you need to transform that into the basis where the Hamiltonian is diagonal. So in principle, you do that by constructing the matrix corresponding to that observable, pretty much in the same way as you would construct the Hamiltonian itself. And then you diagonalize the Hamiltonian, you get this matrix, and then you can transform any operator you like into that basis. So this is just standard linear algebra, of course. You can find a lot of these canned subroutines for diagonalization and all kinds of other tasks on this website. So in case you don't know about this, it's a very useful site with lots of subroutines in both C and Fortran for almost any numerical task you can imagine. Right. Yep.
Are all of it all diagonalizable?
Say again?
Are all of it all
diagonalizable? Yes, I guess. Well, okay, so here we are dealing with the Hamiltonian, so normally the matrix is Hermitian, right? So then definitely it's diagonalizable. Of course, you could have some, I mean, if you just go to some general problem, you can have non-symmetric or non-Hermitian matrices that have left and right eigenvalues and so on. But for a Hamiltonian, if it's a well-defined Hamiltonian, it should for sure be diagonalizable. Otherwise, it would not be a good Hamiltonian. So we will talk about often situations where the Hamiltonian is real valued, so then it will always be symmetric. And of course, in the general case where it's not real, it is Hermitian. Yeah. Right, but so here U comes from diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. So first, so what I'm saying is that let's just say it's real. So by this I mean that this is a matrix which is diagonal. So when you call your subroutine with this matrix, you get this matrix U, which, by the way, it is the matrix that diagonalizes the Hamiltonian like this, but its columns are also the eigenvectors. If you look at U as columns, then these columns will be the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. So that now the point is that when you have done that, you need to transform your other operators that you're interested in into that basis, and that's the way to do that. No, okay, so what's the problem with this? Well, we already said, so the number of basis states, of course, grows exponentially with n, and you are not going to be able to do this unless n is smaller than or equal to something like 20. So you have two kinds of problems. First, you need to store m squared matrix elements. Well, that's not really true, as was already said here. It's a sparse matrix, so you could just store it in some more compact form. So that's not really a problem. But the time to diagonalize a matrix, even if it's sparse, if you want to completely diagonalize it, find all the eigenvalues and eigenstates, the time taken is m cubed. So that grows very fast with n, and that's the limitation. So I will talk about how to use symmetries to improve this situation a little bit, and that's the main point of all this. But still, let's look at how we would do if we don't use any symmetries, if we just use the basis I just discussed, just to warm up a little in terms of these of these state representations and so on. Okay, so now I will use this notation. So A is now going to be an integer, and the bits of A are going to correspond to spin states up or down, right? So I want to have some mechanism how to refer to these bits. So this is the notation I will use. So A square bracket I will refer to the ith bit of integer A. And normally we number the bits in the integer from 0 to 31, for example, in the case of a normal integer. So this first bit, this is one integer and its bit representation. The first is going to be bit 0, this is going to be bit 1, and the leftmost is going to be bit 31. And we are going to use the first n bits for an n spin system, okay? So in the Hamiltonian, we have this diagonal operator. So to when we look at the state and we want to compute, let's say, the diagonal energy, we just need to look at the bits corresponding to neighboring spins. And since we're dealing with a chain, we just need to look at two nearby bits. And there are, in most programs, as I said, there are some functions to examine bits. Now, when we construct the Hamiltonian, we also have this off-diagonal term which flips two spins. So now I just want to introduce a function which, when you actually write the program, you have to implement it in some way, but in these pseudocodes, I will just assume that we have defined it. And that it's such that it takes as input an integer a and two integers I and j, which will correspond to two sites in this spin chain, and as output, so if you call this function, flip of this one will be the integer when you have changed those two bits in the Hamiltonian. So if there was a 0, it goes to 1, it goes to 0. Okay, so just as an example, in Fortran 90, there is this function, IEOR, so which is an exclusive OR on integers. So how does this work? So we can actually use, what this does is it takes two integers, in this case A, and in this case I take 2 to the I, and then it takes all the bit pairs, And it will perform the exclusive OR operation on all those bit pairs. And the exclusive OR, of course, is true if the two inputs are different, and it's false if they are both the same. Okay, so we want so this actually will flip this bit I. I will show an example here, but I want to actually flip two bits. So then I want to use 2 to the I plus 2 to the J. So let's look at how this works. So this is our integer A, which represents the state. So this would represent the state with spin up, up, down, down, up, down, up, and so on. Okay, so that's the state in which we want to flip these two bits, I and J, meaning we want to make this a 1 and this a 0. Okay, this is the integer 2 to the I plus 2 to the J. So it's clearly 0 everywhere except 1. And by the way, here I assume that I and J are different, which they always will be. If I and J would be the same site, this would not work, but these are always going to be different. So 2 to the I, oops, what am I doing here? So 2 to the I is the one with one here, and 2 to the J is the one with one here, and so this is 2 to the I plus 2 to the J. Okay, so this is what the exclusive OR does. It takes all these pairs of bits, and it performs the exclusive OR operation. So you see here, if we look at sites not I and J, we always have zeros here. So then we are always going to get 1 if there was a 1 up here, because exclusive OR gives 1 if they are different. If they are the same, we get 0. So this exclusive OR operation is going to change all the bits where you have 1s in this second integer. So it's doing exactly what we want. And it's a function, so it's going to be used in some sense that B equals I exclusive OR, then B is going to be this integer. So this again is something where you see how the bits are useful, because this is a very simple operation in the computer, and we immediately get that state integer. So if these were just some elements in some vectors that we made ourselves, then to get that integer B, which is supposed to be this one, we would have to go and change those elements. Well, that's no big deal, but then we again would have to perform that kind of summation that I wrote up there to get the number B. But since it's just manipulating the bits, that translation is done for us for free. So is this clear what it's doing? Right. Yep. Right.
You have to do all. You have to do all the pairwise.
No. See, this function does all the operations. So this is really what that function is doing. It's doing the bitwise operation on the whole integer. So it's not like you need to do it 32 times. You only do it once. So if I say here B equals this expression, then B will be the integer corresponding to those bits. So it's all done at the same time. Well, in the computer, I'm sure it may be actually done at the same time. I have no idea how it's actually done inside the computer, but the point is it just one call to that function does all the bitwise operations. Of course, there's some other exclusive OR function which takes as input just two logicals, right? And then it gives you true or false. And that function is just, what is it now again? I think it's in Fortran there's a non-equivalent, which is exactly the NEQV or something like that, which is a Boolean function. So this is not a Boolean function. It's a function that takes integers as output and gives an integer. But what it does is some bit manipulations on those functions. If you use C, there's something similar in C as well. So now let's look at the first example of this pseudocode that I have. So this is now the full thing you need to construct the Hamiltonian. And in fact, in the program, if you look at the programs on the web, which will be there soon, you will see that it actually is not much longer in reality. So what do we do here? So to construct the Hamiltonian, we have to loop over all the states. So if we look at the blackboard here where I did these things, so we loop over all these states, and then we act with the Hamiltonian, and we see what states we get when we have Hamiltonian, when the Hamiltonian is acting, and then we fill the elements of that matrix. So at some point here, I have declared this matrix H, the elements of which go from 0 to 2n minus 1 in both directions. So we loop over all the states. And then the Hamiltonian acts on these nearest neighbor pairs. So we need to loop over all those. Our sites or spins are labeled from 0 to n minus 1. So I loop over I. And this gives me the neighbor of I. So I just use the fact that we have a periodic system. I always will assume that we work on a periodic system. So then we use the modulus function. So I'm sure you know what the modulus function is doing. So this just gives I plus 1 if this is less than n. And if I plus 1 equals n, it will give us 0. So it's exactly doing what we need. Yeah? Right, so these are elements of a matrix. So let's it's a two-dimensional array, right? And again, so it's exactly that kind of structure of size 2n minus 1 squared. So let's just see what it's doing. So we looped over all the states. And then for each state, we need to loop over all the sites in the chain. So now we have our nearest neighbor pair. So now we need to look at the bits and see if the bits are parallel to each other or anti-parallel. So that corresponds to spins, equal or different spins. Okay, so now in this pseudocode, I just again refer to this bits with these square brackets. In the program, if you use Fortran, for example, you will need whatever function in Fortran looks at the bits, and then let's see now suddenly I forget, what is it called in Fortran? Does anybody remember now? What? The function which just examines a bit. Test, I think it's IB test, or bit test, or something like that. I have it in my programs, but I just forgot it now. So I think it's B test or IB test or something, which just takes two integers. So the first is, let's say the integer a here, and the second one would be the bit number, which would be I. So whatever it is, it's something which examines these two bits. So we can compare if the bits are equal, that means we are dealing with parallel spins. So sorry, let me go back to Hamiltonian. So what we are doing is we are acting with the Hamiltonian in this form. So first we look at the diagonal part. So if the spins SZ, which are the bits, if they are equal, this will give us plus a quarter, right? If they are unequal, it will give us minus a quarter. So that's the first thing we are doing, just looking at the diagonal part. And then we will need to do this spin flip part, so which can only flip to anti-parallel spins. So if the spins are both up or both down, this operation will destroy the state. But if they are up, down, or down, up, we can flip them, and then the matrix element is 1/2. Right? So that's what we are doing. Yeah?
I feel silly, I haven't just noticed this, but why are we talking about Heisenberg model when we are only storing up or down?
Oh, because it's a spin 1/2 quantum Heisenberg model, right? So in a classical system, the Heisenberg spin is a vector in three-dimensional spin space. Well, it's also a vector in the case of quantum mechanics, but now it's quantized, right? So,
but then wouldn't we need to be able to store superpositions in order to properly?
right, but now what we are doing now is we are looking at the basis.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So we look at this basis, and you know, the basis states are by definition not superpositions.
Yeah.
Right? So later, of course, when you let's say you have diagonalized it and get the eigenstates, those eigenstates will be superpositions. But now we are just looking at the Hamiltonian. So where am I? Okay, so this is now the case where the bits are equal, meaning the two spins are either up or either down, both of them. I don't need to know which case. In both cases, the only thing we get from that is a diagonal matrix element, and that should be plus 1/4. So now the state label is A, so HAA is HAA plus 1/4. Right? Okay, now if it happened that the bits were unequal, that means the spins, those two spins are either up, down, or down, up. Okay, then the diagonal matrix element is minus 1/4. In addition, we can flip those two spins. So the Hamiltonian will flip those two spins. And here I just use the functionality we just discussed. So B equals flip Aij, meaning that bits I and j of A will be flipped, and that will give me the integer B. And that's the state which that part of the Hamiltonian then connects to. So HAB equals 1/2. So, question? Yeah?
Did you initialize the Hamiltonian to be zero matrix?
Right, that we should do. So yeah, I should have said that. So. And in these pseudocodes, I leave out all those things that I think you will understand that we have to do. So here, indeed, the Hamiltonian is initialized to zero. And in connection to that, I should also say that, you see here, I add to the Hamiltonian and subtract from the Hamiltonian. Well, so here I could not just say HAA equals 1/4, because there will be several contributions to this diagonal matrix element, because for each A, I'm looping over all the nearest neighbor pairs. And of course, they all will give some diagonal contributions. I need to add them. Now, in the case of the off-diagonal part, in this particular program, each pair A and B will only appear once. So I can just say HAB is 1/2. I will never get the same pair A and B again, because each A I only get once, and within that loop, the pair that I flip is always different. So I can never get the same B for given A. So that's fine. But later on, you will see that also when we start to use some symmetries, I will also have to be careful here and also add here. Let's see what else. Well, that's really it. So I hope this is also clear now, right? So in a sense, this is really completely trivial. In fact, all of exact diagonalization is in some sense just a trivial application of quantum mechanics, right? We know what we do in quantum mechanics. We can construct the matrix form of the Hamiltonian or any operator we like. So we just need to choose a basis and then construct the Hamiltonian in that basis. It's just that normally when you do some analytical calculations, you don't really normally have to think of it in this kind of at this kind of level, although you all have done things like that, which is really in the end equivalent to this before, but you maybe don't think of it like that. Yeah.
So A is a variable,
right? No, A is just a number. Right, because this is the loop. So A is the number which, in this particular case, is both labeling the states, and its bits are also directly representing the spin states. Right. So in this case, we use A as a loop index, because it corresponds to this labeling of the states, and the bits of A at the same time are the spins. So later this will be slightly different, but in this program where where the basis is enumerated in this way, the bit representation at the same time acts as the labeling index of the state. So now when I go on, that will no longer be the case, and you will see what I mean soon. Okay, so without further discussing what we will do with this Hamiltonian, let's go on. So except to say that, well, when we have finished this, we have the Hamiltonian, then we feed it into our favorite diagonalization routine. We get the eigenvalues and the eigenstates, and then we can compute some expectation value. For example, we may want the ground state expectation value of some operator. Then we also construct the operator. And normally, any operator we look at will be similar to the Hamiltonian in the sense that it will have some diagonal parts, just some products of SZ operators, and it will have some off-diagonal part which involves flipping spins. So constructing the matrix corresponding to some operator is really very similar to doing the Hamiltonian. But then that matrix will be different, so it will not be diagonalized by this transformation. So this is the transformation that diagonalized the Hamiltonian. And so A will not be diagonal. It will be some matrix. But we can then access any matrix element of it. So if we want some expectation value in some state, it will be a diagonal matrix element. But it also has off-diagonal matrix elements in general. All right. Okay, the problem of this again is that the matrix becomes very big. We cannot deal with it for very big systems. We can go a little bit further if we do block diagonalization. So this is schematically what we are doing in block diagonalization. So if we just construct the Hamiltonian like we just did, we will get something where the matrix elements, well, as was already said here, the matrix elements, most of them are really zero. But if we look at the non-zero matrix elements, they will be scattered all around this matrix. So there's no particular pattern of it. So in block diagonalization, what we do is we use symmetries in such a way that the non-zero elements fall within this kind of block structure. So if we use one symmetry, we would make blocks like that, where, again, we may have a lot of zeros inside the blocks, but there are no non-zero elements outside the blocks. And why do we do that? Well, because then these blocks can be diagonalized independently of each other. Right? If you think of that diagonalizing Hamiltonian, if H is itself is diagonal, then this diagonalizing matrix U will also be block diagonal. It will have exactly the same block structure. So that means that we can construct, the basis corresponding to one block, diagonalize it, then do the next block, and so on. And sometimes we don't even care about all the blocks. We may just care about the blocks corresponding to some specific quantum number. Now, the blocks can often also be subdivided further into blocks. It just depends on how many symmetries we can apply. We can go sometimes to many, many steps here and subdivide the blocks into smaller and smaller blocks. So that way, we can reach larger system sizes because now we have to diagonalize smaller matrices. But still, it's not that we can go really high. The largest we can do nowadays on a big computer is something around 40 spins. But without using symmetries, we can only do maybe 20, so roughly twice as much. Okay, so the simplest is just using magnetization conservation. So what is the magnetization? It's the sum of the Z components of the spins. This is conserved by the Hamiltonian, right? Because, okay, so what is the Hamiltonian again? It has the the Z part, which is diagonal. So this, of course, commutes with that part. And then it has the spin flipping term, where always one spin is flipped up and one spin is flipped down. So that means that after that kind of term has acted on a state, the magnetization doesn't change because one SZ was increased and one was decreased, so the total MZ is not changed. So that means that this MZ commutes with the Hamiltonian, and that means that if we just arrange the states in a different order than we did before, we automatically get this block structure. And in fact, we don't need to even really care about, okay, how do we order these blocks. We can just say, well, we just construct all the states with a given magnetization, and that will be one of the blocks. So the number of states we have in the block depends on what the magnetization is. So the largest block has this many states, so that's easy to see, right, because you have n sites, and out of those you have to choose n over 2 with spin up and n over 2 with spin down. So it's just the number of way to choose n over 2 distinct position in a among n positions, right? So this is just simple combinatorics. Okay, so this is actually very simple to use this magnetization conservation, because this is such a simple thing. It's something which is already diagonal in the basis that we are working on. Later, so this would correspond in our case to the first step to make these blocks. Later we will talk about how to split those blocks further up using other conserved quantum numbers. So in particular, we will use the momentum. So we will, within a fixed magnetization block, we will have states of different momentum. But for now, let's see how we deal with this magnetization. So now we will no longer use the same label to label it, also to order the states and to contain the bits that correspond to the spins. We can no longer do that if we don't include all the spins, right? So let me jump back and say again what the point was before, just to make it absolutely clear. So we could use this numbering here because this includes all the states, right? But now if we don't even include some of the states, let's say we just want the states with magnetization zero, then this state would not even be part of our block. None of these states would in fact be part of our blocks. Well, it depends on how big the system is. But we would only, so then we would have to find the first state which has zero magnetization, and that's the one we would call zero, or in fact we will then call it one. There's no reason to start from zero anymore. So let's see here explicitly how we do that. Yeah, please.
So then you're not rotating to a different basis, but you're permuting the rows.
Right, right. Okay. Exactly. It's just a different ordering of the states. Exactly. So now let's construct the Hamiltonian in a block which has n up spins. So if we talk about the magnetization, that's the number of n up minus the number of n down times a half. But we can also just equivalently label the blocks by how many up spins. So let's just do that because it's slightly simpler. So now what we do is we will have m states in our blocks, whatever m will be. In the case of zero magnetization, m will be this number, and you can easily compute it for other cases. But initially we don't even need to know what m will be. But now we will have one number here, a, which refers to the ordering of the states, so that plays the role of this label here that I called A, and I still call it A. But now I actually need to store those integers that correspond to the states that we actually keep. Right. So I will now construct a list which I call SA. So SA with A goes from 1 to M, those are all integers. Let me immediately give an example here. So this is, let me show you what this pseudocode is doing, and then I will go back to that one. Okay, so now again we loop over all the states. This is just one way to do it. One could do it in another way too. But now we are going to loop over all the states, and then we are going to check if those states, which again correspond to integers or to some bit representation which we use for the spins, we can check now if the states have the magnetization we like or the number of up spins we like. So we just S of I is again the bit, which in my notation is 0 or 1. So if we add up all the bits, that is the number of up spins, and if that is equal to our desired n up, then it's a state we want to keep. If not, we don't want to keep that state. So this line is only going to be executed if we want to keep the state. So if we want to keep the state, then we increment this state counter. So this is again reset to 0 initially. So the first time this is true, that will be our first state. And then we store that integer in as this element SA. Right? So this is explicitly what would happen for a four-site system. So when we loop over all integers like that, it corresponds to looping over the bits in this way. Well, so this is the first one where the magnetization would be 0 in the case of a four-spin system. We have four bits that we use, and two of them are 1 and two of them are 0. And that would be actually the third integer. So the first is 0, 0, then we have 1, 0, and then 0, 1, and then 1, 1. So this is integer, the third integer. And it's, again, given by the bit representation. So this is the number we store. So S1 is going to be 3. And this is its bit representation, which we don't need to care about. It's automatically encoded in that integer. So when we just go on in this subroutine or this in this loop, these are the numbers that we will store. So there will be 6 states in that block, and these are the actual states. Well, so these are the integers that represent the states through those bits. Okay, and in the end here, I store in M, I store the size of the block. So at this point, A is going to be 6 in this example, and M is going to be 6. Okay, so now we need something else too when we construct the Hamiltonian. Before, when we had all states in the block, when we flip 2 spins, we immediately get the state label corresponding to that new state. We could just say B equals flip, blah, blah, blah. In this case, when we flip the spins in the Hamiltonian, by the Hamiltonian, we are not flipping spins in the label. We are flipping the bits in these integers that we have stored. And when we have done that, we need to find the state label correspond to it. So, for example, when we if we flip these 2 bits here, then we get what state do we get? Which one did I say? So if we get we get that one. So that was not such a good example. Let's see another one. Let me find a good example. Let's say we have a state, the second state, which is the integer 5. And we flip these 2 bits, then we get that state. So now we want to find where in the list that state is. So when we just flip the bits, we get 9, but now we actually want to find that it's state number 4 in the list. So when we have flipped the bits, we need to search for 9 in the list, and then we will have to see, well, at what location was that state, because that's the corresponds to the location in the Hamiltonian of that matrix element. So if we flipped it here, we got there, so it will be element 2, 4 in the Hamiltonian. So we need to have a subroutine, for example, which can locate the state for us. So we can take advantage of the fact that the list is ordered, right? So when we go higher up in this list, these integers grow, so this is an ordered list. So that means that we can do bisection in the list to locate whatever number we need. So for example, if we are looking for 9, right, so then we have no idea initially where it will be, so we will just know that it will be, the location will be greater than or equal to 1 and smaller than or equal to 6. That's all we know. So that's what this subroutine is doing first. So B is going to be the location, meaning this index that we eventually find, and S is this state integer. So initially we just said, okay, the minimum B it can be is 1 and the maximum is M, and then we are going to do simple bisection. So then we take the more or less half point here, and then we can compare, is what we are looking for less than what we have at that position or larger than what we have at that position. And depending on that, we reset these B min and B max and then narrow it down. So this is where we're going to look now. We are going to look halfway between the minimum and maximum, and then we look at that position. Is the integer we are looking for less than what was at that location, or is it larger? If it's less, then we know that we can shift the maximum position, that it could not then be larger than that. And if it was larger, then we shift the minimum position. And then if S was equal to B, which would be covered by else here, then we have actually found that number. Right? If SB equals S, then, okay, B is what we wanted. So then we just exit this loop, and then this will return the value or the location B. And that will go on until it has been located. So it's bisection, so that means the expectation of the number of times that we have to do that is basically log 2 of M of the system, because every time we have the range. Yes, please.
Just a typo, probably. You probably mean that B min equals 1, B max equals M to be outside the loop, I imagine.
Yes, very good point. Thanks. Yeah, right. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, good. I'll change that. Yes, because we changed B min and B max here. So, yeah, of course, that's just what we started. Great. Okay, so then we know how to locate it in the list. So again, this was something we did not have to do in the initial way of doing it, because then the same integer served as the locator in the list of state as the holding vessel for our spins, for our bits. All right, so now let's just make the Hamiltonian, and you will see it's not much more difficult than before. Okay, recall, we label the states A to M, and M is whatever the size of that block is. So again, we have assumed that we construct in a block of fixed number of up spins. And the state integers, as I call them, which hold the bit representation, those are stored as integers SA, where A goes from 1 to M. And the bits in those integers, they correspond to the Z components of our spins, right? Okay, now this is how the Hamiltonian is constructed. And okay, sorry, let me jump back and compare it to what we had before. This is what we had before. Now we just need to change it a little bit. So again, we loop over all the states, but now the states go from 1 to m. And then we loop over all the sites, and again we find the neighbor of site I, so we have our site pair. Now we need to look at the bits, and now the bits are held in SA. So we look at the ith and jth bit of that integer SA. And again, if those spins are equal, those bits are equal, we just have a diagonal contribution plus a quarter. If they are unequal, then we have a diagonal contribution minus a quarter. And then we need to flip the spins in that holding integer, and we flip spins I and j, and now I call that S. So S is just one integer, and this is the list element SA in a completely different list, so I hope that's not confusing. So this is what we get when we flip those two spins. And now we have to locate that integer in our list. So then we call find state, which we just discussed, and that gives us B, the location in the list. And now we add 1/2 to that element. Actually, in this case, I could also just have said HAB equals 1/2. You cannot get the element B more than once for given A, so that would be. But this is fine, of course, as well. So is that clear? Yeah, please.
Is this just for one block?
This is just for one block, right. In a program, well, it depends on what you want. Sometimes we actually want just the block with zero magnetization, so we don't even care about all the blocks. Sometimes maybe you want to do all the blocks, but this is just doing that block. Yes?
If it's just one block, so why are we summing from 0 to A minus
1? So I just labeled now from 1 to M. So this is not the magnetization. So M is just now my... Yeah, so these are the spins. So by block we mean the block in the Hamiltonian, right? So these blocks are now labeled by, if you will, the number of up spins. So this block could be number of up spins 0, 1, 2, blah, blah, blah. So now we just, the way I have discussed these pseudocodes is that we just do it for one of these blocks, whichever it is. The number of up spins is fixed and it corresponds to fixed magnetization. So then we construct, so you see here, this is the basis we construct. We demand that the sum of the bits equals n up, so that corresponds to so many up spins. And then, this is independent of the block, except that this m is the size of the block, which we got after we found all those states. And this is just constructing the Hamiltonian of that block. So, normally you would not make a Hamiltonian which can hold all those blocks. You would just make a Hamiltonian matrix for one given block and then diagonalize that block and then, okay, maybe construct another block. So then also, of course, anything you compute, if you just use one block, that would just be computed in that sector. But for example, if you're looking at a particular state, you would know probably, okay, I want the state in that block, the ground state, for example, in a specific magnetization sector. Okay, I think that's it for today. So next time we will talk about momentum states. Unless you have any more questions about this now. Is it clear how to do it? So if it's not clear, you should really look at the slides that I post, and I will correct this typo. This should be clear, because otherwise, if this is not clear, the momentum states we will discuss will be completely confusing to you. All right, so let's continue tomorrow. Thank you.